Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the Y2K bunker that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing brandless brands, mental health in the advertising industry, and one of the largest art projects which has never been exhibited. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Matt Huynh. Matt is a visual artist and storyteller based in New York City. His bold brush and ink paintings are informed by poetic Eastern Sumi-e ink traditions and popular contemporary Western comic books. His animation, paintings, and comics interrogate war, diaspora, refugees, asylum seekers, and migrant communities. Huynh's work has been exhibited by the MoMA, Smithsonian, Sydney Opera House, Brooklyn Museum, Brooklyn Academy of Music, and New York Historical Society. Clients include Washington Post, New York Times, and The Atlantic. His most recent work on the world's first Instagram documentary with SBS was about the Rohingya refugee crisis and was nominated for a Walkley Award for Excellence in Journalism. Matt also happens to be an amazing Jackie Winter artist as well. So Matt, we're so happy to welcome you to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good. Thanks for having me, you guys. It's been a while.
We're so happy. And I have to just point out that we are, again, continuing with the trend of Australians in New York.
Australians in New York.
We should just call the show Australians in New York.
There's a lot of them here.
Yeah, there are.
And Bianca, you and Bianca obviously, you know, are very close over there, and she often refers to you as her Gemini twin.
Yeah, there's a lot of us, actually. There's a lot of Geminis in the creative field and a lot of Gemini illustrators, I think.
Last time I was in New York, Matt and I accidentally ended up seeing Weezer at a concert together, and I sent you a video, Jeremy. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. Weezer is very close to my heart. Speaking of Gemini twins, Laura, we had our Christmas party here last night. We had some tarot readers.
You sure did.
And we had some magicians. We had a grazing play. We grazed.
Oh, I grazed. I demolished that grazing plate.
What was in your future?
There was some like deep, intense stuff. And then there was also stuff about like follow your dreams and believe in yourself. So that's what I'm going to do today.
Excellent.
I'm believing in myself so that I can get through this hangover.
Wait, what? The grazing plate had affirmations or something?
No, they were tarot readers.
I completely. All right. I didn't understand that at all. Okay.
Yeah. No, they were separate things, I promise you, but they were all wonderful. The magician was so fun. Magic just turns you into a child and it's the best. Like, I couldn't stop like giggling and tell it. I was just like, stop it. How? It was great.
Like the bumper stickers say, magic is real. I believe it. Okay, let's get stuck into it straight away. Laura, this first link comes straight from the outline. I got to say, Laura, I've been noticing a bit of a trend here with two links in your podcast outlines for the last 2 weeks.
You know what it is? It's because you inspire me, Jeremy, and I just want to be more like you.
Okay. What do you got?
No. Okay. So as you said, this one comes from my perennial favorite outline, and it is all about the online retailer Brandless. Have you guys come across Brandless before?
Is this an American thing? Because I've never seen
it. It's an American thing.
Okay. Matt?
Yeah. I think it is more of an American thing. Like you do spot the odd targeted Instagram ad or something, but yeah.
Yeah. I think Bianca first actually sent it to us like ages ago, but basically Brandless was launched in 2017 in San Francisco. And the whole shtick is they claim to lower prices on basic household goods by cutting out what they call the brand tax, or basically like the hidden inefficient extra cost that you typically pay for a retail brand to cover all the logistical and branding expenses. So on the website, you find a collection of sort of everyday essentials presented as purely sort of functional and generic. So for example, they sell glass cleaner instead of Windex, or wild albacore tuna and hot water and not, you know, John West, and fluoride-free peppermint toothpaste and not Colgate. And each of these comes in this sort of simple packaging with not much else other than the name and what's inside that package. So the about page describes how their team circles the globe to create a curated assortment of high-quality products, doing thorough research, product vetting, and taste testing to ensure that every product they sell meets incredibly high-quality standards. So to quote them directly, "We'll never make you choose between 12 different kinds of quinoa. We have one. You can trust it's a good one and it's organic." And that sort of carries through every product, where they claim to follow best practices for each category. So cotton is always organic, chips are non-GMO, paper products are sustainable, so on. And the other key thing to note about all of the Brandless products is that everything they sell is $3. Again, claiming that by cutting out the middleman and shipping direct, they can keep these sort of costs down for the consumer. So there's a bit of an obvious paradox here that the outline piece delves into, and that's the fact, obviously, that Brandless is in itself just another brand. As the piece states, you know, you can sort of scan through the 300 or so products that Brandless offers, and you start to see a brand that is engaging with all the same kinds of signifying and effective gambits that regular brands do. For example, you know, you've got that sort of, there's the sans serif type and their monochrome palettes. They very deliberately convey a sort of utilitarian sensibility, and it's a calculated attempt to tell consumers that, you know, Brandless is useful, Brandless is different. And you could argue, I guess, that the fact that it features this minimal aesthetic only goes further to show that great care has gone into designing the look and feel of these products. And likewise, the sort of companies like I'm Not Like Other Brands sort of shtick is meant to communicate something about the values of those who buy those products, which is branding in its purest form. So it's kind of obvious, really, that Brandless is anything but a refutation of branding. But yeah, it would be kind of silly to operate under the illusion that Brandless doesn't exist for the same reason that all companies exist, you know, to make money. And that's not to say necessarily that the company isn't going about this in a positive way or that doesn't serve a positive purpose. But the idea of brandlessness in any sort of suite of products for sale, I don't think is that feasible. But acknowledging this, the article also takes a look at what happens when we ignore that paradox for a moment and investigate what exactly it is about our present moment that makes brandlessness attractive to consumers. And you sort of, they look back on the history of branding. It's quite interesting to see how its importance has grown from something that was originally there to simply sort of provide information to something that is there to insinuate and support a lifestyle, which we talked about some time ago on the podcast where we talked about getting rid of all advertising. And when you look at how the supply and demand balance has shifted throughout the 20th century, as consumer capitalism came to sort of dominate the world more and more, you can see a time in which the surplus of options that shoppers were given meant that purchasing goods was no longer just a matter of satisfying a human need. And companies increasingly realized that effective branding could signify an entire lifestyle, and the importance of branding grew. And so I guess in many ways, you can argue by the late 20th century, and certainly today, in most cases, branding is actually more important than the product itself. And the writer offers up a great example for this when they consider two different advertisements for Dove soap. I love this part of the piece. So there was one created in 1957 and the other in 2006. So the first ad pays mind exclusively to the product itself, like its look and feel, the breakdown of its chemical composition, how effective the soap is. But the 2006 ad, which was created for the Super Bowl, was part of Dove's famous campaign for real beauty. And over the ad, sort of 45-second long ode to women's insecurity, Dove products appear exactly zero times. And it no longer matters really that Dove soap has certain cleaning ingredients. And it's now sort of all about how the brand associates itself and therefore those who use it with this message of social empowerment. Anyway, the article takes a pretty critical look at this sort of culture of branding and capitalism. There's some fabulous lines in there, such as, "Branding forms a symbolic and linguistic terrain on which we live our lives, mediating our interactions with each other and ensuring that whatever futures exist are circumscribed by corporate imaginations," which I kind of loved. Maybe I should get that tattooed on myself. So anyway, I recommend that anyone listening should go have a read of the full piece. It's a good read. But in the meantime, I'm going to shut up. I want to hear from you guys. Maddie, you said you've come across Brandless in like the odd Instagram post. What do you think of it? What was your first impression?
We're so inundated with advertising and being advertised to. So my very first impression was I kind of dismissed it. And I didn't learn very much about it until you sent me this article and was forced to take a closer look at it. And there was like its environmental focus, its focus on being organic and allergy conscious, how much it tries to simplify decision-making and remove obstacles to your decision to buying products, specifically products where you don't want to have like a second look at, or you don't want to invest too much energy into thinking about. I didn't really know that side of this company. But yeah, it's very interesting the way they've positioned themselves, because I think they have been effective in removing a lot of those obstacles and making it easy to defend. You know, I was talking with my partner about when our families used to buy generic brand products, and house brands used to be kind of the default just because it was the cheapest.
Yeah.
But when they would buy something that was a name brand, it would be something that she would take to school because they knew that the kids would talk about it, you know? So it would be things like snacks and cereal and things like that. And I think we choose brands because we have a story to tell about them, whether it's a story we tell ourselves by using them, or it's a story that we tell others that we're just like you, we can afford this too, we can buy this too.
I reckon this all falls in as well to that sort of conversation we were having recently about discourses, Jeremy, and how I think, you know, brands and the brands that you choose to engage with form a part of your discourse, which I know you hated that piece, but you're looking at me like, shut up, Mark.
No, on second listen, actually, it made a lot more sense. I kind of got it. I think it was in the moment I wasn't
sometimes
kind of
picking up to I'm too intellectual for you. I get it. Now, Jeremy, what do you think? Is brandless just another form of branding, or is it just a way to sort of make Silicon Valley people feel okay about buying home brand products?
Oh, look, of course. I mean, of course. Like, I don't know. Everything about this just turns me off so much. And it's kind of like, just like we were talking about with Georgia, you know, and typefaces the other week. It's like, and I don't remember who said this, but you cannot not communicate, you know, so everything communicates something. And obviously, I don't know if it's a McLuhan thing or something. But yeah, I mean, I remember kind of one of my first kind of semiotic papers when I was studying communication design was looking at kind of, well, I think it's called Black and Gold or Home Brand, the two kind of generic brands that kind of we have here. And so, yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I think from a design perspective, you know, we're always talking about here how brands are developing, you know, their aesthetic always in reaction to kind of something else. So obviously the huge influx of kind of consciousness in design in the greater public has meant just a huge amount of more designed things out there. So it's only natural to want to see things that are kind of undesigned, but it's impossible to do that. And for me, I don't know, like I find it really like there still needs to be, from a marketing perspective, kind of a selling point. And the fact that all of these products as well don't really, they're completely anonymous. Like, you don't know where they come from or who's making them. Mm. There's qualities about them. But I think that's what I really value about a brand. Like, and sometimes I think for, you know, for fashion especially, it's about kind of heritage or quality or kind of materials or, you know, who else is wearing them, kind of things like that. And I think it's really disturbing the way things are going. I think one thing that really illustrates this well, I'll post a link to this, but, you know, all the fashion houses rebranding in these like anonymous sans serif typefaces. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, YSL, Balenciaga, Burberry, Berluti, and then Balmain all kind of just now all look the same, basically. We were just recently in San Francisco as well. And one place, you know, I hear on podcasts all the time about Everlane, you know, like it's a clothing label and has no brands. And apparently, again, it kind of reduces the cost of things. And it's a huge thing in America. And
there's that big thing now as well of like companies getting like designer bags and stuff from the factories that make proper designer bags, but because they come without the label, there's that cut in.
And so me and B went into the store and like it was just packed and it was mobbed. And I was I couldn't really understand. It's like, and I was like, I wanted to do some shopping and like, but like, I don't know, like for me, like I want a brand on me, you know, like, I don't know, like I really kind of, I like that kind of association. And it's like, I don't know, like maybe that kind of goes to my own, you know, deep insecurities, but I don't want to be kind of anonymous. Like I want to be part of a tribe and kind of, you know, part of a bigger
but
thing.
But that is a tribe. And so I think that's the thing is that like the idea that you can not be part of a tribe by buying something that is brandless, whatever, I think is kind of naive. Like I think that makes you part of a different kind of tribe, you know? Like it says something about who you are if you're the kind of person that buys these products, and that's fine.
But that's the thing.
But there's no way to completely separate yourself from that.
Oh, that's the thing. It's so gelled. It's like a brand, even if you don't have a logo or even if kind of you're using the sans serif typeface and like, you know, everything is kind of, you know, very systematic and put in there, that's a brand. I mean, that's
yeah.
pretty
it's
obvious.
It's funny because I think the name is misleading, brandless. Like, but I don't mind necessarily what they're actually doing. Like the idea of simplifying the offering, making it, Maddie, as you were saying, like having for things that are not that important, like window cleaner or whatever, not having like millions of things on the shelf to choose from. And there's like crazy messages about like or crazy sort of colors and shapes and whatever they're designed to just make you buy, you know, one dishwasher powder over another.
I don't think what they're in competition to is the story or the brand where you really want to identify. Like they're not in competition with Coca-Cola or Cheetos or Nike or Vegemite. They're in competition with the things that disappear into your life. They're in competition with salt and cotton balls and tissue paper. Things are just household essentials that you don't want to think.
I take my cotton balls very seriously, actually. No, but I mean, it reminds me kind of the skincare brands, The Ordinary and Deciem. Because I when I first finally came across The Ordinary, I fell in love because they have this like, compared to everything else in the skincare market, they have very clear packaging with very singular concentrated ingredients that are just like outlined really clearly. And they're able to sell it sort of quite close to cost price. And it's great. And I think kind of what Brandless here is doing here is meant to be similar, but I came across an interesting comparison piece by Insider where they took like a bunch of the top products from Brandless and compared them to the equivalent products at Trader Joe's. And they found that Trader Joe's actually came out on top price wise most of the time. So like the whole $3 thing, they've positioned themselves as these like, we're passing our savings on to you. But there wasn't really that much of a cost saving by cutting out the brand stuff because it is still just a brand.
No, that's all part of the part of the story and part of the brand. I think another interesting thing is to look at kind of the flip side of this, especially more relevant here in Australia, where we moved to plain tobacco packaging. So basically, you know, no tobacco companies or cigarettes have kind of like are allowed to be branded basically. So everything is in a plain box in a really kind of terrible color. And, you know, and they've used the same approach of a non-brand to actually stop people from using something.
Mm-hmm. And statistically, it's been like fairly successful.
It's been very successful, but they've kind of, it's like, you know, they've looked at kind of, you know, what is ugly and unattractive. So it's like, what color will people not like? So everything's kind of this olive green. What are they literally putting disgusting pictures, disgusting, you know, or like, you know, bad typography and kind of all those other things. So it's interesting to see it kind of work the other way.
Absolutely. Being that, you know, obviously a lot of the work, all the work that we do is commercial and sort of can, a lot of it sits in that branding space. I mean, Jeremy, you've already sort of had your thoughts here. You definitely don't want a brandless world. But Maddie, what about you? Would you want a brandless world? Would that make life too boring?
I mean, I love stories and I love telling stories and I love being told stories and I love buying into stories. So I think branding is important, even if that branding is that I'm not branded or I'm not associated, or if that branding is I buy local and I support individually family-owned businesses. You know, I think we do vote with our wallets and we can tell ourselves that I'm this kind of person. I'm a collector or I'm an environmentally conscious kind of person. So I think what becomes problematic and slippery is when brands don't give us that mantra or that aspiration, but they deliberately deceitful when they lie to us and distort and perpetuate like a false narrative and a dangerous narrative. Obviously, you see that politically. But that's, I
what
think that's
politicians
no.
Never. Yeah, that's a really valid point. One thing that I was thinking about was just like, again, I like this idea of simplifying decisions and not of, you know, having these ridiculous amounts of products, blah, blah. At the same time, I like brandless in that it sits amongst all the other stuff that's on offer. If we only had things like brandless to choose from, I think that's actually really scary. The idea that like everyone only has like one choice of thing and you're just, this is just dictated to you with no color, no story, no nothing. That to me is like, I don't know, I can totally see like a Black Mirror episode.
Well, look, we'd love to hear from you. Do you have any thoughts on this yourself? Let us know. Write us at podcast@jackiewinter.com and we'll move on to our next link from here. Okie dokie, it's my turn for the week. And my link for this week is a bit of a heavy one. In 2018, Never Not Creative, Unlimited, or UnLTD, and EveryMind conducted the first major study into the mental health and well-being of the media, marketing, and creative industry in Australia. The purpose of the study is to bring transparency to the mental health issues affecting individuals in our industry and the attitudes towards mental health. So the results were just published, and it's making waves in industry publications, but the one that I'm highlighting today is from Mumbrella, a local kind of marketing industry site here. So first, let's break this down a bit. Never Not Creative, really interesting not-for-profit initiative supported by Streamtime, which is some project management software that's been around for quite a while here in Australia. And now look, in the past, I've avoided linking to these sorts of studies that can sometimes come off as real blatant promotional plays. We talked about before Upwork, they did a huge survey on freelancing I was going to link to and talk about the other week. But on the contrary, the work that Never Not Creative is doing, I think is really vital and important. And look, furthermore, it's a topic that's really close to my own heart as someone who has struggled with mental illness personally, as well as those close to me. So I'd really encourage everyone to check out the work that they're doing and really get involved if you're so inclined. They kind of have a lot of their stuff over on Medium and are using Medium in a really interesting way as well to build community. So yeah, definitely check that out. While there's no big surprises in the actual study, spoiler alert, the study reveals that of the 1,800 people surveyed, 56% of workers show symptoms of depression, 20 percentage points more than the national average. So look, I mean, it's a relatively kind of small sample size, you know, for Australia and a kind of a study in general, but still some really great data. And I think it's really important that each industry have a discussion on this topic, as it's something that's still really taboo in the workplace. Personally, I feel that Australia has a huge edge on places like America in terms of how mental health is discussed and treated. our National Health Service plays a big role in that. Mental health on its own is a huge topic. Of course, we can't even scratch the surface on. However, it's definitely something to be a growing problem, especially and somewhat ironically as well in wealthy Western countries. So I guess one of the main questions that I had here was, you know, does our industry create mental illness through its nature, or does it just attract a certain kind of person that might be more predisposed to it, like in the creative industries itself? So I, to that end, I thought the one and only comment on this article was actually one of the most powerful statements outside of the actual kind of piece itself. And so I thought I'd just kind of quote it here verbatim as a bit of a talking point. So sorry, I don't have the name of this commenter here off the top of my head, but I did kind of copy and paste into my show notes. And he says, or she says, "I believe they are more depressed and anxious." And I think they, meaning the people who work in the advertising and creative industries. "And the reason is that their product promotes anxiety and depression. The media is a virtual reality, which shows a negatively curated selection of horrible stories about society based around crime or social conflict. When they can't find local horrors or conflict, they are increasingly able to import it instantly from overseas. I spent some of my journey to work today reading the newspaper about a man who murdered his family in the US. Why? Reading and viewing stirs up a range of negative emotions, which can only be fixed by turning to the people around you and realizing they are nothing like the figures whose stories are portrayed in the media. Meanwhile, marketing professionals focus on stirring up status anxiety and generating false needs. The need to consume the toxic media product for professional reasons makes media practitioners depressed. I think that in the future, media consumption will be seen as having the same relationship to mental health that smoking has to physical health."
Wow. Excellent comment. Wow.
Yeah.
So look,
better than most comments.
I did not expect that comment. Wow.
Did not expect it either. So yeah, I mean, that's why I kind of want to chat about it. So look, Laura, we've often talked about stories here that are very critical of our industry. Again, that advertising by its nature is meant to invoke fear and other negative emotions. Do you think there's any merit to this claim? If so, do you think it explains any of the results in this survey, as this commenter states, or do you have any other general reactions to this piece?
Yeah, I really agree with you that studies like this are important. It's a small sample size, but it's the biggest and best that we've had so far. And I mean, yeah, of course, it's important firstly to sort of expose these glaring and often sort of silent issues. And then hopefully beyond that, to actually work with industry bodies to create systems to support and sort of then lessen the problems, hopefully. And I guess the numbers, as you said, whilst awful, then not a huge surprise, or at least I didn't feel like they were a huge surprise. The one that did get me, which was one that they had in the, I clicked on the link you sent, that was the actual study result. This one kind of got me. It was nearly one in five of us being within the creative industries, showed severe or extremely severe symptoms of depression compared to the 12% national average. One in five is a lot. That's a lot. And when you think about sort of the number of people in most workplaces and how many people, you know, given that statistic would have to, I mean, again, small sample size, but it's pretty nuts. But yeah, the numbers were sort of quite in line with other similar studies I've read that have looked at professions like law or medicine, where the hours are also long and then the pressure sort of immense. And there are some really interesting correlations between the qualities of these jobs and the level of mental health issues. But whether this crosses into causality is another question altogether. I think that was really interesting what you raised, because, I mean, look, hold on. First, I have to say that correlation is certainly a significant enough reason to encourage us to put system in place with, you know, within these industries to better support people. It doesn't need to be causation in order for us to want to do something about it. But whether it is the industry itself that actually causes these conditions, it's hard to say. And personally, I think there probably just have to be elements of both. For example, on the one hand, I guess it's not hard to see that perhaps people who experience greater ranges of emotion, who are intelligent, who are reflective, perceptive of others, etc., also sort of more creative people or better at creative pursuits and therefore are drawn to creative careers. And it's also those attributes that often lead people to suffer from conditions like depression and anxiety, or perhaps people who put a lot of pressure on themselves and who are drawn to sort of stressful situations as a way to, I don't know, prove themselves or something, are also drawn to careers in these areas and therefore are the types of people who might exhibit anxious or depressive tendencies. And then on the flip side, I think it's quite obvious to see how, you know, the pace and the demanding nature of these roles could itself have a very negative effect on those that are previously and otherwise healthy, or how it could certainly worsen one's condition. I think the other thing the study points out is the correlation between job satisfaction and lower levels of depression and or anxiety. But again, this could perhaps be flipped around to say that people who don't suffer from depression and anxiety, perhaps they are more capable of finding satisfaction in their jobs, or rather those who do suffer from these conditions would feel a level of dissatisfaction regardless of the role they were in because of the tough sort of realities of living with those issues. It's really hard to know. But as I said, all of that said, in my very unscientific opinion. Yes, I do think that the advertising industry, at least, yeah, I don't know about the whole creative industries, I can't speak for it, but the ad industry, at least, I do think it can have a negative effect on many of the people who work within it. I feel like every second yoga teacher I have is someone who has at some point cracked and left the ad industry. And I believe, yeah, partly that comes, I think what you hear from many people is that it comes from the meaning or sometimes lack thereof, I guess, behind the work involved, and also the intense pressures and hours that you're required to work. Of course, within that, there are good and bad workplaces, fulfilling and unfulfilling projects and positive and negative people. But we can all agree, I think, that working in this industry is stressful. And as we all know, stress is proven to have detrimental effects on all aspects of health.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think kind of, yeah, the one reason I'm so glad that these conversations are happening is that I hope it kind of can go reach up to the higher kind of levels of people who make decisions, especially how to design workplaces and kind of, you know, policies and work that actually take mental health into account. And I think it's kind of one of those things, you know, similar to kind of climate change, that until it's talked about in a way that also kind of puts, like, you know, that comes back to people's pocketbooks as well, there's not going to be kind of much change. And I think, yeah, when you look at the actual kind of financial toll of mental health, like on the workplace in terms of lost productivity and lost hours, et cetera, I think, yes, sometimes that can make it a bit easier to understand for people who might not have that kind of direct experience and take it a bit more seriously.
That's really one thing I did want to say as well, that something that's both very sad and very interesting is something that I learned when a dear friend of mine passed away as a result of his own depression. And veterinarians have one of the highest rates of suicide, which I never knew. It's approximately four times the national average, or one every 12 weeks. And I'm sure there are many reasons that compound to give us that result. But in talking to other vets at the time, many mentioned how being in a position where you're putting down animals when they're sick or injured, often multiple times a day, can really desensitize you to the idea of suicide and make it seem like a more valid option than it might to people who aren't around that all the time. And it's just something that had never occurred to me before. And there's all these groups, there's one in particular called like Love Your Pet, Love Your Vet, that sort of aim to raise awareness about the huge levels of depression, severe depression in the vet industry. And I guess that was just an interesting and, of course, like very sad example of how the nature of one's work can affect your mental state.
Yeah, I do. This reading this made me wonder how specific and unique this is to advertising and the creative industry. And I don't deny, like, these are smart creative people and they're working at the coalface of commercial and capitalist pressures. But we have also felt and seen like more the language of creativity used across industries more today. Like, you could live in a creative neighborhood and you could be of a creative class, but that can dispossess and art wash neighborhoods. It can, you know, commission inoffensive street art to dress itself up as an edgy creative neighborhood. Being creativity could be used as kind of a guise for austerity in government policy and in business, where, you know, your problems with an institution, with education and healthcare, or whatever it is, it might not be because of bureaucracy or because it's underfunded, but because they need to be creative and they need to find agile solutions. And to be a creative worker, you need to be free and on call whenever. And, you know, the tools of a creative worker, our phones, our smartphones, our laptops, and being able to work anywhere without owning anything, and being able to have to take your success and health into your own hands. And that sounds like a freedom, but it sounds like also like a great capitalist commercial pressure that's flipped onto an individual and placed this obligation on the individual. So I think that's like a real pressure that's come out of like an emerging trend and this emerging capitalist pressure as well.
Well, let's take that a bit further, Matt. I mean, I really did want to chat with you about this because, you know, your work is very activist in nature and you skirt a similar line to the work we do here. So yeah, you know, you have to work commercially. It's how you make your living. You work across many different mediums and you have worked in advertising as well. So how do you reconcile, you know, these two aspects of your practice in terms of the more, I guess, you know, socially active one and the commercial one?
Yeah, when we first met, Jeremy, I was pretty much completely doing commercial work. I was like brand new to illustration and I was working for a commercial studio in Sydney. And I was doing packaging and storyboarding, concept art, like very advertising, commercial heavy work. And I would draw 8 hours a day for this super rendered output that didn't have much of my own voice in it. And it put my own health at risk and it gave me kind of permanent carpal tunnel. And that's kind of what led me to finding a different way of working and a different relationship to drawing and illustration today. And also creativity, like all the typical ideas I get about, you know, where do your ideas come from? How do you stay inspired? How do you navigate creative block? And the way I've resolved that and with my like physical health is turning to this gestural ink and brush work that I do today, which comes from its principles and its roots in Zen calligraphy. And that takes a lot of its focus from the body and breath from Tai Chi meditation practices. But I'm motivated a lot by changing culture and changing stories. And so I think like commercial work is, and it's always been very attractive to me because of its reach and its power. And that's where I want to go if I want to have an expectation. Like, again, we're always inundated with advertising and we're always very cynical now and sophisticated about how we're being sold to. But when you have that, you can subvert the vocabulary and symbols and aesthetic and the representation of what's normal. Like, who is a normal person? What's a normal family? What's a normal relationship? What's a symbol that, and what's an aesthetic that's good or beautiful, and what's powerful and free and safe? So I think, I don't think that's bringing, when I'm hired in that position or when I enter that position, I don't see it as me being impertinent or bringing an agenda and my own tools and symbols and my own history and my own message to these things. I see it as being greatly respectful to myself and my client and my audience, because we're asking them what's true, you know? We're asking them, like, do you recognize yourself in these symbols versus the plethora of work that's just being broadcasted to you and that's not listening to you and doesn't imagine you as a humane, intelligent person? So that's why I do the work. I think that's where the work gets done. And for whatever cynical reason there is today about representation and diversity and signaling wokeness by big brands and commercial brands and everything, it's obviously a ripe time for changing that vocabulary and having representation of marginalized people, bringing the marginalized into the mainstream and reaching niches. So that's why I do it.
Absolutely. I mean, clearly you take an enormous amount of responsibility for the work that you put out. And I think that's a really, it's a beautiful thing. Jeremy, what about you? How do you balance? Because the business is built on commercial work. How do you feel about this stuff?
I feel very conflicted every day about it. You know, it's really difficult. Like, I think, you know, we're in a really interesting position where, you know, sometimes I, you know, look at all of our artists' diverse practice, because especially in this knowledge economy, everyone has to have multiple sources of income. And I kind of feel it's a bit of a balancing act. And sometimes, you know, it's about being supporting yourself through more commercial means. So, you know, our artists can, you know, continue to explore their personal or fine art practices in different ways. I also try to make sure that, yeah, that we also deliberately keep a balanced kind of diet of different kind of things that we do kind of creatively, and that there is a spirit of social enterprise in some ways, as well as, you know, looking at things like, you know, like the workplace and trying to do my bit as a boss there as well.
Because I think for me personally, like creating advertising doesn't, like, you know, excite me, but what does excite me is working with talented artists to create beautiful artwork. And like, I think we're in a really lucky position here where it might be that we're creating something for an insurance ad or whatever, but I still get a very sort of a feeling of like fulfillment, and I find it very rewarding, because despite the fact that, yes, it's an ad about insurance that we're creating artwork for, the process of working with a talented artist to create a piece of artwork feels important regardless of what the thing is for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Matt brought up kind of, you know, Zen in his practice, and I like to think, you know, there's a bit of, you know, Buddhist practice in the work that we do. I know that sounds like really kind of corny, but, you know,
because it's so calm and quiet, is that right?
Well, you know, it isn't. And I think, you know, that's an interesting kind of challenge to bring up. And I like that, like, I grew up working in the service industry and kind of, you know, in hospitality, and I always kind of loved that whole idea of
at
Bagel Plaza in Merrick, New York, if you want the best bagels in America. But this whole idea of kind of, you know, just being of service to our artists, being of service to our clients, I think sometimes I try not to focus on the end result and what the actual kind of interpersonal aspects that are kind of happening there in terms of, you know, how to bring in kind of qualities that I kind of value personally and how to kind of put that into the company, you know, just things like kindness and compassion and patience and all those things, and just putting that out there in the world in some way. So look, I mean, in addition to that, like, I'm really proud of some of the more socially engaged work we've done. I mean, specifically this last year, we've done amazing work for local organizations here. Headspace, not the app, but the other organization Headspace, and Smiling Mind, two organizations really kind of tackling this and bringing mindfulness into the workplace in really awesome ways. So look, this is our last episode for the year. We're going to have a bit of a break. We're entering into a time for quiet and reflection, which can often be a very very healing and restorative period. So look, I often talk about the work that we do. We're knowledge workers. We're kind of like mental athletes. We always need to kind of look after our minds. So before we go into our final link for the year, I'm just curious to hear from both of you on your own personal strategies for maintaining and improving your own mental health. Is there a particular thing that you do that other people might not know about or that you think is valuable that you'd like to share?
Hell yeah. Therapy and medication. Yeah. No, I mean, I too have worked through various mental health issues with some heavy support on your part, Jeremy. And the biggest thing I think, I mean, it's everyone says this over and over again, but sometimes you really need it like bashed into your head, is that getting yourself into the hands of a caring and competent professional is a really, really important thing. That and all the boring regular stuff, you know, I exercise, I try to eat well sometimes. But yeah, I mean, whilst it's like, I think it's, you know, it's vital to do that stuff for many sort of health reasons, I think it's insane to think that everyone should be able to manage their mental health on their own through the power of green smoothies and yoga. And for some reason, there's a lot of shame in the idea that you could potentially need help, especially when that might involve drugs. But holy moly, like the stuff is there for a reason, and it's designed by people who studied for many, many years just to help people like you. So I think don't shy away from that. And the other thing I'll say, somewhat annoyingly, I know, is time. I think over time you do get to know the patterns of your mental health and develop some understanding that it is this fluid evolving thing. It's very starty, stoppy, for want of a better term. And for me, coming to peace with that has been an enormous part of being healthy. I think like accepting that it's a thing that you have to actively work on that may always be there in some way, but that it's not who you are. Just that mental shift is for me a huge part of maintaining an overall healthy balance.
Matt, what about you?
Well, Lara, like what you mentioned about this kind of the kale smoothies and like this kind of like very consumerist, performative kind of a hashtag self-care and wellness ideology that's emerged over the past years. I think maybe I'm particularly sensitive to it being in the US, where there's a lack of housing and basic income and social security for vulnerable people. And, you know, if you're a marginalized person in a violent, oppressive culture, like to paraphrase Audre Lorde, it is a radical act when it's self-preservation. So I think like particularly with a healthcare system that's beholden to insurance and litigation and the politics of the day, I'm skeptical of this performative consumerist self-care, because it does push the obligation of your health and productivity onto an individual obsession, and it expresses itself, you know, in affirmations on soda cans and conspicuous performance, but it isolates people in their individual responsibilities. And if we're obsessed with being well individually, it's difficult to be well together, and it's difficult to identify economic and structural failures. So I would say, I think it's important to listen and look after something and someone other than yourself, and to look after and look towards things that are bigger than yourself. And that might be to seek collective change. And that sounds very like rah-rah and activist-y, but it might start very small and local. If you're having trouble eating well, if you don't particularly care about food, if you're not a big foodie, cook with and cook for other people, or take someone out to dinner. And you can turn something that's a maintenance and an obligation into an act of generosity. And I think that's like a very direct and a very simple way of getting outside yourself. But I've long been a practitioner of meditation, and I'm a big believer in journaling as well.
Me too.
Those are really good.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me personally, it's really all about my own meditation practice. And one thing I think that was really powerful for me to hear at one time was, especially when I was really time poor, it's like, you know, I do 60 minutes of practice now every day, but sometimes I can't do it. And even when I was trying,
in
I was
one
like,
sitting?
No, two sittings, 30 minutes a day. There's a really powerful practice called a 3-minute breathing space, which I try to do throughout the day when I can't get 30 minutes. And one thing I found is that I heard if you want to do 20 minutes a day, you don't have to do it in kind of one sitting. You can actually do it throughout the day and can have the same effect. And this is where I've actually found the Apple Watch kind of really helpful with the Breathe app. And
sometimes it comes up and I'm like, fuck off, I am breathing.
So I kind of suggest, you know, if you haven't done meditation and you're a creative person and you're worried that you don't have the time, you can kind of break it apart. It's really cool. It's called the 3-minute breathing space, if you want to look up that exact practice. But
Sorry. Well, what I tell people if they struggle with finding time in the day is you know, there's that saying about it doesn't matter how long you take a dip for, you're still going to get wet, you know? So it all helps. It's like, it's about the habit.
That sounds very like California, like it is cowabunga, bro.
I think that's our episode title right there. And of course, look, if this is something that resonates with you and it's beyond the scope of other things, there's so many different organizations out there to kind of help. Here in Australia, we have amazing organizations. There's Lifeline at 13 11 14, the Suicide Callback Service on 1-300-659-467, and Beyond Blue as well. And in the States, there's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and they're at 1-800-273-8255. But yeah, Google or anything else will get you to the right place. So yeah, there's always help out there, which is an amazing thing to, you know, to know about. So yeah, thank you both for your feedback here. I think we'll move on to our final link next. Okay, wrapping us up for the week as well as the year. This is, I think, the first time The New Yorker has made an appearance on the podcast. I'm wrong. When was the first time?
Your profile of Al Hirschfeld, I think it was.
No, that was on, actually, It's Nice That.
Okay, there was something.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that and figure this out. Matt, this was an amazing piece. You know, sometimes with The New Yorker, there's actually an amazing, I'll put a link to this. I don't know if it's still around, but there was a newsletter, a weekly newsletter called The New Yorker Minute, or something like that, which basically, there was like someone who kind of wrote and summarized which articles you should read and which you could kind of skip in The New Yorker. And it was really amazing because, yeah, like they put out so much amazing content every week. It's just phenomenal. So look, tell us a bit about this piece. This was totally kind of new to me, talking about the artist Isabel. And I don't even know how you pronounce this, if it's Meige or Meige, or I'm not sure. But Matt, take us away.
So this is an article from The New Yorker about a medical secretary who obsessively pursued leading photographers. And there were photographers who, they weren't necessarily like the biggest in their field, but they were contemporary photographers that were on her radar and that she was personally a big fan of. And she would obsessively pursue them to use herself in their work and to make a photo with her in it. And she built this collection of these photos, her own collection of these like chosen artists, using her body as the medium, using these artists as the medium, and blurring the lines of artist and audience and collector, medium and subject. So I thought it was really interesting because for a lot of reasons, I guess we're kind of in that world where the artist is the subject and art is performative and everyone is a broadcaster, but also that she's such an interesting character. And this was a story that came out 2 years ago, but has been on my mind. And she's a character that's been on my mind because even when they tracked her down, the profile and the descriptions of her, she was, I don't know if you guys found this, but my impression was she was quite elusive and I didn't get that much clarity and that much revealed from hearing her speak. But it was interesting that they tracked her down and they brought all this work together and they found this work and told this story.
Well, like there's this, it's sort of an interview with her, but it's also not at all. There's like very little, because I didn't actually realize until quite late in the piece that the author had actually met with her.
Yeah, the narrative of the piece was strange.
I loved it. I think it's a beautiful, it's a really fascinating piece and it is weird. Like there's no other way to put it. It's a weird story.
I hate to say it, but it's like, she's incredibly, and I say this as a compliment too, like she's incredibly ordinary.
Yes.
And I don't think, like sometimes I kept wondering if she knew what an amazing task she was undertaking. Like what an incredible, because she was very quiet about it. But there also seems to be a side of her that's very in control and not manipulative, but like on top of things. And
how promoted though, right? Like quite, yeah. I get such, part of me gets like real creepy, like stalker serial killer vibes. Obsessive pursuing of photographers. And it sounds, who was it? Bill Henson, I think, was saying that like she would try to track him down for ages and that he would, anytime he went overseas and stay in a hotel, there would be a note for him. And like, it was like, how does she know where I'm going? Like, which that to me is like not super kosher, but it is also fascinating, this idea of having the same subject approached by so many different artists in the same medium, but with such different approaches.
Henson's really interesting because he was, I think he was the only artist that she was pursuing that refused to participate. And he refused kind of on an intangible hunch because of her obsessiveness. Has that ever come up with you? Like, have you ever had to turn away working with a client or an artist for something that felt wrong or something that you've over the years have learned is kind of a something that pricks your ears.
Anything come to mind for you at all?
I mean, you do get a sense, not necessarily to turn it away, but you do develop a sense of when a project's not going to be smooth for whatever reason. Like, there's definitely, you get certain types of emails, and I don't mean just the obvious ones, like when someone's being like a total prick. Like, that's, you know, everyone can tell that that's not going to go well. But even when all intentions are sort of positive, sometimes you learn to see the warning signs of when perhaps, like, you can see that, like, I don't know, there's some lack of communication between them and their team, or there's whatever it might be, and you kind of can sense that a project is going to be a difficult one. But also, I'm not really in the position normally of turning the projects down unless the artist would like to turn it down. So I've had people turn projects down for many a reason, whether that's, you know, money or don't have time, or as well, like, sort of moral reasons. I'm like, I remember one person didn't want to work with an electricity company because they just wanted, like, this, nothing, because no clients have stalked us, as far as I know.
Money's like an interesting aspect of the way she approached people, because she refused to be paid for any of her modeling.
And the work hasn't been exhibited anywhere either, so
she also wasn't guaranteed a copy of the artwork as part of it. Like, she wasn't paid, and she also, like, it says that she would write to them afterwards to request a print. And there was one photographer who actually refused to give her a copy of the work because he didn't want his work to be part of her collection, which is interesting that she wasn't even, like, guaranteed the finished piece. She was part of making it, but she wasn't actually guaranteed.
I thought that was so interesting because, so it was Patrick Feigenbaum. And by doing that, I guess he could claim an ownership over that work. And there was another photographer, Henry Foucault, who said that it would have been easier for him to make a picture with a model that he could pay. Do you think there's, like, a relationship between payment and ownership over a work and an artist's investment over it, like how much they put themselves into it, how much they put a claim over it or distance themselves to it?
Well, Maddie, you've asked basically that whether there's a relationship between the money involved in an exchange of, you know, creation and ownership over that artwork, you know, and does that affect how an artist might, like, what their level of involvement and their sense of ownership over the artwork is depending on how it's been paid for or not paid for. Did I get that right, Maddie?
I think so. Like, is there like a subconscious thing, or maybe it is a conscious thing. Maybe it's a self-protective, defensive thing, where if you know that these are the limits and the boundaries of my right, and this is the limit of how much I'm going to be paid in exchange for that, you see an artist kind of put boundaries on themselves as well, or, you know, kind of in a similar way to how Isabel, her relationship with these photographers, they had a hard time explaining how this work belonged in a body of their personal work, that it really felt like her own
collection. Yeah, because it says there were some photographers that asked her to, like, once they heard about her project and stuff, but for the most part, it sounds like they didn't ever initiate the work. She initiated it, which I can see why it feels like her work, even though they're the ones taking the photograph. Actually, in fact, I like that in the piece they refer, like, they always say it as making a photograph instead of taking, because they talk about, like, how you're making this sort of piece of art, which I think is a nice thing, the side note. But yeah, I think definitely there has to be some relationship between payment and the balance of ownership and investment in any creative endeavor, because partly there's, obviously with certain amounts of payment or whatever, cover the amount of time you can spend on something. That's sort of a commercial given, I guess. But there's also that sense of, like, when someone is paying for something, they then feel the right to dictate certain things about it. And I think that's something that gets interesting about the client-artist relationship. Like,
well, it's also just the nature of kind of collecting as well. And, like, you know, whether or not, like, and this is kind of in more the fine art realm, but, like, whether by collecting a piece, you know, do you own part of that person? This actually reminds me of a similar, not similar at all, but, like, a quote-unquote art project I tried to start when I was around 18 and 19 and living in the city. I had to get a checkbook from the bank to go, like, to actually pay rent for the first time, but I never wrote checks, but I had this checkbook around me all the time. So I'd go to openings and, like, art art event, and if I saw someone famous, I would ask them to write me a check. People thought it was crazy. So I have one from David Cross, the actor, one from Douglas Copeland, and one from Spike Jones. I did it 3 months, and people found it really weird when they were confronted with a checkbook, because they thought like, okay, like, are they like, identity? Am I going to be identity theft? And like, and so, but I asked people to write an amount and put something in the memo and then sign it, and then I came to Australia, so I stopped it. But like, it, there is kind of something similar
it's
to
like
this.
They like, actually like gave you money.
No, no, it was my checkbook, and I said, write me a check.
Jeremy,
for my
I don't
checkbook.
Know how checkbooks work, to be honest. I've never had one.
but there is an aspect of almost like kind of like autograph collecting kind of in a way here, where it's like, you know, you're initiating this thing with like another celebrity, and now you kind of have this kind of piece of them there. Obviously, the representation here is totally different, but, you know, some of the concepts are same in some ways. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we're focusing on the exchange of money, but it's also that the photographers, they struggle to explain just how the work that they did with Isabel fit into their own body of work. And I know like there's a lot of artists on your roster who, and myself too, who, you know, like we do a lot of like self-motivated, self-initiated personal projects, and that's what attracts maybe commercial commissions, with a view to apply something that we've innovated with personally to a commercial project. Is there like a clear, when you look at a folio or like an art, the way an artist works on a job, is that apparent? Like, is it clear that there's a delineation between what they're doing out of their own instigation and what's happening when a third party approaches, like an Isabel or like a client?
I think in the best cases, there shouldn't be too much. Ideally, an artist has developed their work and their approach to work in a way that allows them to freely work, like when they're working with clients, that they can really lean into their the same style that they would, you know, and obviously that relies on the clients being open to that as well. But I think ideally I'd love to see when someone's work is, you can't tell what's sort of been commercial and what's been personal. But at the same time, I think there's something incredibly special about the fact that personal work is just that, that there isn't someone, because I guess obviously that key difference is with personal work, you're the only one responding to it and you're the only one giving yourself feedback or making those changes compared to having other parties in there who are involved. And so I think sometimes that works one of two, it can work either way. So sometimes with personal work, it means you push yourself so much more in such weirder ways because there's no limits on it and there's no client saying, no, that can't work, no, that can't work or whatever. It needs to be blue. And in other times, I see where like personal work doesn't get pushed far enough because there isn't someone critiquing it. How does that, like, I mean, for you, Maddie, do you feel like you, because like often I think like someone would do a piece that would be great if it just had like a round of revisions on it, you know, like, and they haven't, because it's personal work, they don't bother to, I'm not necessarily bother, but because it's only them looking at it and not one person will see everything that is right or wrong about a piece, you know? So compared to when you have multiple heads sort of reflecting.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you bring that up, like as a someone that comes from producing, because I never thought of that perspective, because you fetishize your personal time, I suppose, and you fetishize like that isolated, like that solitary time. But I always think about, I guess the greatest surprise for me is when there is a commercial scenario where I haven't seen it coming, like an Isabel, like I haven't seen this coming and I don't know exactly the scope of it. And we're kind of dancing with each other and I'm pushed to do something that I wouldn't have gone on my own. Like I wouldn't have taken myself to that weird, uncomfortable place and I'm forced to go there. So that's what stands out to me are those kind of projects where I wouldn't have even thought to go with that subject matter or these collaborators, I suppose.
Well, look, there's so many different things to pick apart here. We didn't even get like scratch the surface here on some of the potential kind of overlaps between, you know, fine art and commercial practice and some of the amazing points you brought up, Matt, but we do have to wrap it up. We'll post those, some of the kind of thoughts that you had in addition on our show notes as well.
Definitely.
But yeah, thank you so much for bringing this up and we'll wrap up now for the year. It is time for drum roll, please. Drum roll. Matt, give us a bit of a drum roll. Get into it. There we go.
That's a good one.
Thumbs up, thumbs down. Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, the completely petty off of our chest. Laura, get us started. What do you got?
I have a thumbs down for the weird mystery that occurred last night. We were still in the office partying around, I don't know, 3 a.m. or something. And eventually people started to go. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go. I've just got to find my phone. And I just had it because I know I'd been changing the music and whatever. It just disappeared. My water bottle had disappeared as well. It was really bizarre. And I searched slept for like 2 hours. Everyone left the office. It gets to 5 a.m. and I finally realize, oh my God, I can do like find my iPhone, you know, on my laptop. And I did that and I was walking around the office. I couldn't hear it because you can press the button that's like play a sound on the phone. And I was pressing it, nothing, nothing, nothing. And eventually I got down to the server room and my phone and some other stuff of mine, my wallet, not my wallet, my water bottle had all been locked in the server room at some point since me. I have no idea how, none of us had the keys to it. And it was like insane. I had to sort of like break into our own server room to get my stuff out. And by that point it was like 5:30 in the morning. So I just slept here. Thumbs down for everything. I am in my party wear still and I feel terrible.
Matt, anything you'd like to endorse, disendorse, or just kind of have a general, you know, rant about?
Yeah, I didn't realize that this would become such a New Yorker fest until you brought it up. But I was on the way to meet another one of our artists, Ilya, at a live podcast reporting for a New Yorker cartoonist, Jason Chatfield.
Oh. I love that show.
Yeah, and on the way, I passed a bookstore and out on the table outside, they had a Webster's Dictionary, a second unabridged edition. And I picked it up for $5 and it's like 3,000 pages. It's huge and heavy. And I wasn't thinking that I would have to drag it around to dinner and to this bar and stuff. But I love it. It's so good. The reason I picked it up is because there's a nonfiction writer for The New Yorker, John McPhee, who I love. And it's what he uses and it's the standard at The New Yorker, this particular edition. It's because it's a dictionary that's before it became very permissive and it became less authoritative. And there's a lot of great illustration in it, there's a lot of great plates in it. But the way John McPhee would use it would be, he would look up very simple words. He would use it in a way that instead of using a thesaurus to find fancy acrobatic polysyllabic words, he would look up their meanings and go deep into the meaning and find ways to express yourself clearer and clearer and clearer with understanding.
My own heart.
Yeah, that's definitely something I've carried across both my visual work and my writing, I guess.
Amazing. Jeremy, thumbs up, thumbs down. Shaka, what do you got?
I got a shaka.
Yeah, you do.
For Larabars.
You and your Larabars.
Okay, Larabar limited editions. Obviously, nothing to do with the affection that I feel for you, you know, as my colleague.
I knew it.
But have I talked about this in the podcast before?
Yeah.
Really?
Love Larabars.
Okay. Well, official endorsement. If you can get that sweet Apple Watch endorsement deal, then I can get my Larabar endorsement deal. Anyway, it is Decorative Gourd season, and Larabar has come to the table with an amazing assortment of limited edition bars. We got Snickerdoodle. We got Gingerbread. We got Cinnamon Roll.
Are they paying you currently?
They're not paying me currently.
You have mentioned Larabars too many times on the podcast for this not to be sus.
Anyway, iHerb. Again, no, they stopped carrying Larabars and sending them to Australia. So we got our lovely staff over in New York too. I ordered like a boatload. They've all arrived in New York. They have then kindly forwarded them onto me.
This is such an abuse of your power, Jeremy.
It really is. But I got to give a shaka to, you know, both Claire and Bianca for being my male mules, as well as Larabar for making amazing bars. Right,
that's all you're importing.
Matt, where can people find out more about you and your practice online? Where are you on the internet?
My website's matthuynh.com, H-U-Y-N-H. My social media handles are Maddie Huynh, like MATTY_HUYNH.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and we will talk to you really soon.
Yay. Thanks, Maddie.
Thank you.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and links can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all the links we talk about in the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter, which has just been completely overhauled and combined with the regular Jackie Winter newsletter, so definitely give it a look.
It's very good.
You can find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. We are about to go on a 3-week hiatus.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, our first episode coming back is going to be completely in response to a letter that we received. So we do really love getting the letters. Please keep them coming.
It could be you.
Could be you. If you like what you hear, leave us a review on iTunes. It helps people find the show. And you can also get a Spotify, Stitcher, etc., etc. Remember, remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, or the new Apple Podcast Player, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you so much for listening for the last year. We will catch you in a few weeks on the flip side. Bye bye. Line and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together. Oh, fuck, I didn't update this motherfucker.
Oh.
1 second.
Maybe we'll take that bit out.
Yeah.